We'll call a meeting to order this morning of the Agriculture Policy Committee at the precise stroke of 10:15. Good morning, everybody, and welcome this morning. We have a couple of presentations from the Department of Ag, and then we're going to be hearing a bill from Chair Hamilton. So it's going to be an interesting meeting this morning, and let's get going right away. First up, a report on biodiesel, and our first two testifiers, good morning.
Good morning.
Identify yourselves, and you can proceed.
Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Similar to the hemp report from last week, I don't intend to really testify when there's a real expert to my right, Mr. Kevin Hennessy for the department. He wrote these reports, more than capable of taking all of your questions, but if there are broader MDA questions, I'll be fielding those. Thank you.
Oh, and I'm Kevin Hennessy, Mr. Chair. I'm with the Department of Agriculture. I'm the bioenergy manager there.
Go ahead.
You wanted the biodiesel report first and the petroleum second, or do you not care?
Yeah, biodiesel, whatever works.
Okay, I was going to do the petroleum replacement first because I'm prouder of the biodiesel report.
Yeah. So.
The petroleum replacement report this year, it's written every other year. So this every odd year, so this was the year where it was written. And it reports on the activities of the Commissioners of Agriculture, Commerce, and the Pollution Control Agency per Minnesota Statute 239.7911 Subdivision B. And these activities include, and I'll number them because I'm going to address them by number as well. One is developing recommendations for specific cost-effective incentives to expedite higher biofuel blends in the state. Two, expanding renewable fuel options available to Minnesota consumers. Three, ensure options are available for all motor vehicles and small engine equipment. Four, work with large corporate automotive fleets to increase use in renewable fuels. Five, work to maintain affordable price for liquid fuels. Six and seven were added in 2013, so they were new this year. Six is facilitate production and use of advanced biofuels. And seven, develop procedures to report amount and type of biofuel used under the state's biofuel mandate, Minnesota Statute 239.791, Subdivision 1C. And in 2013, that statute changed to biofuel mandate from ethanol mandate as it was previously written. So if you're okay with it, I'll just proceed with each category. Number one was specific cost-effective incentives. The largest one being the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council, partnering with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture on a $3 million grant program over 2014 through 2015 biennium for ethanol-compatible infrastructure that met certain goals, in particular for awards, high volume, visibility of the station, a metro location on a station, and conversion of as many pumps as possible to offer E15 and E85 at the same pump, in addition to other considerations as well. So, for example, a station that wanted to convert all four of their pumps in the metro area on a main highway with over 1 million gallons of fuel sold a year would be considered a high priority candidate. We also have had the RFS volume goals, the renewable fuel standard. If you're not familiar with it, they have annual goals for the renewable parties. The importers and the refiners have to meet certain volume requirements annually on biofuel that they blend with petroleum fuel. The volumes for 2014 that were proposed in November of 2013 still have not been finalized at this point, as well as obviously no goals for 2015 as well at this point. They're supposed to be coming soon, but they've been saying that for quite some time. And last of all, in this category, the B20, that is biodiesel, 20% original engine manufacturer option. We have been supporting that, and that effort is led by the National Biodiesel Board. That is to manufacture engines to be B20 compatible, so they would be able to handle up to B20 fuel.
Mr. Hennessy, could you talk for a minute about the challenges facing the industry in ramping up to E15 in terms of the procedures that have to be followed, any new equipment needed by the stations themselves, and how is that going?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have that coming up, some of that coming up in item two.
Okay.
If you'd like me to go over that, and then I can take that question.
Okay.
Number two is expand renewable fuel options, and what it actually says in statute is by obtaining federal approval for use of additional blends that contain a greater percentage of biofuel. In reality, these waivers with the EPA are a federal process that is now being tackled by trade groups such as the Renewable Fuels Association and Growth Energy at the national level, as well as industry themselves like Butamax and Gevo on the biobutanol front. They tend to be very involved, very expensive. The E15 mandate, however, did use quite a bit of research that was produced through this legislature's actions and studies done through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As far as the UST compatibility enforcement, there was EPA ruling in 2011, not ruling, but EPA guidance in 2011 that didn't recommend, but it said that all equipment needed to be approved for the fuel being stored, which meant that anything over E10 needed to be compatible with whatever it was going to be, E15, E85, E30, or biodiesel over 20%, which doesn't affect biodiesel so much because 20% is our maximum blend in most cases. Our statutory biofuel blend right now, E10, is because ethanol is the spark ignition fuel that's available. The waiver by the EPA must be approved according to statute for all motor vehicles regardless of model year. So E15 being a partial waiver for 2001 and newer vehicles does not qualify for state mandate under 239.791. And last of all, in this section, biobutanol production is proceeding with three separate projects, that being Gevo, who owns the Laverne plant now, Butamax, who's looking at siting in Minnesota, and the Green Biologics, who is converting the central Minnesota ethanol plant in Little Falls. And that's all I had for number two.
Anything about the number of stations? I got some information from the corn growers. They're helping, as you mentioned, with the trying to help fund some of these conversions. How is Minnesota done, and what are some of the impediments to getting more stations up on E15?
Well, as of yesterday, I went over, because we coordinate these grants with the American Lung Association of Minnesota, had a total of 40 stations that we're working on up to this point, spending $895,000 of our $1 million at the Department of Agriculture. Not all of these are metro. Not all of them are all pumps at every location, but they've targeted that as much as possible. The equipment used to dispense and store E15 or any blend of ethanol, alcohol over E10 does need to be compatible with the fuel stored. So those, the storage tanks and the containment equipment and the vapor recovery equipment, as well as the pumps themselves, need to be either UL listed or manufacturer approved for those fuels.
Question by Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hennessy, I remember coming in, and you don't know what you don't know, right? Just briefly talk to our members and whatnot and explain the RFS and the RENs, if you would, please.
Mr. Hennessy. Chair, Representative Hamilton, briefly. You've challenged me now. The RFS is basically the national biofuel mandate where volumes of renewable fuel in four different categories need to be blended annually by refiners and importers with petroleum fuel. So in the end, that comes out to, I'm trying to think how to say it simply, but that each refiner needs to be responsible for so much fuel, and they show that compliance with the RFS through either fuel blended or if a third party gets a hold of fuel and blends it, they can take what's called the renewable identification number from the fuel, which is generated at the time the fuel is produced. They can what's called strip it or separate it, and they can sell that into a market. An obligated party, a refiner, importer, then can buy that certificate, that RIN, and they can use that as their compliance without blending fuel themselves. But the idea behind the RFS was always, of course, to get more blending of renewable fuel out.
Thank you. It's a complicated system, so go ahead.
Well, I'm up to item three, which is ensure options and fuel supply, which basically is to continue to offer non-oxy premium, which we do at select stations over 400 in the state, and E10, which currently is offered at pretty much all stations around the state, for equipment that can only take those, or for owners that desire to put those fuels in their equipment, be it small engines or collectible cars or what have you. This item needs to continue to be considered as E15 gains more market penetration, because then we'll be on to another level of vehicles that might just require E10. Item number four, work with large vehicle fleets. Our largest fleet is the state fleet, which maximized its ethanol use in 2011, according to the data that was analyzed for the report. The fleet committee, of which I'm a member, is focused on the reduction of petroleum use with other technologies as well, such as hybrids and electric vehicles, along with flex fuel capable vehicles. So in that sense, petroleum use is going down, as well as petroleum use has been going down overall, while gasoline use in particular has been going down since 2007. So you are, in a sense, going to be using less petroleum fuel because you're using less fuel overall. And other large fuels around the state have followed similar trends to the state fleet, I found in making calls around to other fleets for the report.
Mr. Hennessy, when you talk about working with fleets, do you at all work with the actual car manufacturers to see if they would encourage or at least allow the use of E15 in some of these newer cars? I know for a while some manufacturers wouldn't warranty a vehicle with E15.
Mr. Chair, we do have a biofuels task force of 10 members that's part of this statute, and one of the members he works for Ricardo in Detroit, who is an engine designer engineering company and consults with many of the auto manufacturers. There are efforts to produce vehicles that not only take advantage of higher ethanol blends and a flex fuel capacity, but to take advantage of that octane as well. So that we are in conversation with them. How much control we have over auto manufacturers, I'm not sure. I think they want to see they always tell me they want to know what the people want. So if there's not a flex fuel hybrid, for example, that you can't buy right now, they always tell me it's because nobody asked for one. So if you want one, ask for one, I guess.
So we pause just a second, Mr. Hennessy. We have enough members present now for a quorum, so we will officially look at the minutes. Would Representative Poppy look at and hopefully approve the minutes for February 11th?
Absolutely, I would do that.
Thank you,
Chair.
Chair Poppy. All in favor of the minutes of February 11th, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion's approved. Thank you very much. So continue on, Mr. Hennessy.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number five is maintaining an affordable price for liquid fuels. Until recently, ethanol was priced lower than blend stock, that is sub-84 fuel, in cost and on a BTU or energy basis. So ethanol is caused for correspondingly lower prices on all ethanol blends. Biodiesel pricing has been dependent on which side of the RFS the blender is, so, and I'll get more into that with the biodiesel report. But prices have tended to adjust and even out overall, and getting into biodiesel pricing, as I will later, is also a very complex issue, but it tends to work itself out pretty well. Item number six, production of advanced biofuel, and this is a new addition as of 2013. We have no advanced biofuel production in Minnesota currently. There is now, however, cellulosic production capacity in Iowa and Kansas of over 60 million soon, 60 million gallons. It's all ethanol production. Most of it is from corn stover as a primary feedstock, except for the Quad County corn producers in Galva, Iowa, who use corn kernel fiber for an additional 2 million gallons in their 35 million gallon corn ethanol plant. And last of all, item number seven, developing reporting methods to discern biofuel type under Minnesota Statute 239.791. The biofuel mandate now instead of an ethanol mandate is making allowances for if butanol or some other fuel was to come along, how would we track that under the mandate? It's currently not necessary because corn starch ethanol is the only spark ignition biofuel in use, but in discussions with the Division of Weights and Measures of the Department of Commerce, having a ticket or paper trail similar to what's done in biodiesel now appears to be the likely solution. So we are talking about that. And that covers it for the petroleum replacement report for the last 2 years.
Any questions from members of the committee? Mr. Hennessy, just a quick question. You talked about the price of E85 or ethanol compared to blend stock of gas. As the price of oil has come down, I've noticed a couple of stations down here in the metro where E85 was actually priced higher than the E10 blend. Is that becoming more common, or how do you see that pricing going into the future?
Mr. Chair, more common, I don't think more common. Still, if a blender is able to take advantage of RINs, the price of ethanol is still significantly lower than the price of blend stock, so you would have ethanol in the 50-60 cent range with a RIN. But if they're buying it from the refiner, then of course for the refiner they need to blend that ethanol, buy that at the price of the plant, and then it's a cost to them. So it kind of depends on where they can get the ethanol from, who's the blender, how it works under the renewable fuel standard.
Okay. I like to tell a story from back home. A couple of our local stations must be working with an ethanol plant and some kind of a program where they were selling E85 for a dollar less than gas. And my claim to fame was I filled up my tank for 83 cents a gallon. So that was pretty good. Go ahead.
Well, next, Mr. Chair, I have the biodiesel report, which is an annual report produced every year. Per Minnesota Statute 239.77, Subdivision 5A, the report is to include information regarding the implementation of the biodiesel mandate minimum requirements in Subdivision 2 of that statute, including information regarding price and supply of biodiesel fuel, impacts of the mandate on development of the state's biodiesel production, and the use of feedstock grown in Minnesota for biodiesel production. We do have part of the statute is there's a Minnesota Biodiesel Task Force, which has 15 members, many from the petroleum biodiesel industries. We have a couple from farm organizations, research organizations, one from a user group, one from an environmental group, one from a grower organization, and one at-large member who just happens to be the person who had my job before I did. So, B10 implementation began last year, July 1st, and ran through September 30th. We at the department consider it a great success. The diesel helpline received no fuel-related issues. There were other changes to Minnesota Statute 239.77 last year from the 2014 statute, which included the date of the B20 mandate being delayed to May 1st, 2018. The months of the B10 mandate are now April through September, not April through October as they were. And the rest of the year, the minimum requirement is B5 and number 2 diesel fuel. Biodiesel exceptions are now defined as exempt equipment, with the nuclear sector having the only definition of when the exemption would end, which is 30 days after biodiesel use is approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The others are all permanent at this point. And number 1 diesel is now exempt from biodiesel blending year-round through May 1st, 2020. We have 3 ASTM standards that we use to guide us in biodiesel fuel and biodiesel fuel blending. We have ASTM 975, which is for diesel fuel oils, which is up to 5% biodiesel. We have ASTM 6751, which is for B100 blend stock, and ASTM 7467, which is B6 to B20 diesel fuel, which is where B10 and B20 would be considered. Biodiesel prices, which is the main part of the report, a lot of graphs, a lot of charts, a lot of data. One section is on rack or terminal pricing, which is where the drivers go to fill up at the terminals or where the pipelines end. There's a lot of summary tables and graphs from our AXIS daily rack terminal reports that we get at the department last year, through last year and historically back into the 2000s when the mandate began. The impact of the federal tax credit was not factored in your report, as it wasn't reinstated for 2014 until December 19th, and then only retroactively for the year of 2014. Third-party blenders, there's a section on them, the third-party blenders and their impact on the impact of the RFS and renewable identification numbers. The graphs show potential effects of non-obligated party blenders and RIN values. These graphs did not include the effects of any retroactive federal tax credit. And this tracking showed a consistent margin of profit throughout the entire year, profit potential for these third-party blenders. And those are non-obligated party blenders. Those are people who are not refiners, importers, who would just buy fuel from the biodiesel plant, buy diesel from the terminal, and then blend them together themselves and sell that fuel. So that price comes right off, that price then of the RIN that they can trade into the market comes right off the cost of the B100 fuel. So therefore, it makes it less than the number two fuel they mix it with, and makes the overall diesel fuel then cheaper on the market. And competition between these two groups can then lower the overall price of diesel. Even the price at the rack last year was fairly close throughout the year, being like a cent or 2 cents for B5 or B10. We also did a week, because I had some access to free data, for the week of May 15th to May 21st to look at retail price tracking. That is some service stations around different corridors that come in and out of Minnesota, like I-35 at Albert Lea or I-94, Wisconsin and the Twin Cities, just to see what retail pricing looked like on both sides of the border. And these show what that week showed is that there's many effects that affect pricing on either side, that there's no consistent. Minnesota isn't necessarily consistently more expensive or less expensive than the other states, but there's other factors involved, such as state tax incentives, such as another example, Iowa has a 4.5-cent tax incentive for B5 or higher blends. So any B5, which actually is D975 diesel fuel and sold in Iowa, can qualify for that 4.5-cent cost off of diesel fuel. Then there's different state taxes on each side of the border. And then the report actually that I was able to get access to shows margins taken by the retailers on each side too. There's just a little bit in the report that you have that shows some of that report, but I have the full week report that I'd be happy to email anyone who's interested. The biodiesel supply, there was an adequate supply of biodiesel in the state throughout the past year with no issues to report for 2014 per weights and measures. Production capacity still is at 63 million gallons in holding, which is enough capacity to meet the B10 and B20 mandates as calculated in 239.77 subdivision 2B, number 2. This number is based on 905 million gallons of annual diesel consumption in the state, which I've arrived at per consultation with the Energy Information Agency and the Minnesota diesel consumption data they had for 2013. They won't have 2014 until about November of this year. So, and then I'll use that for next year's report. And feedstocks, we have three plants, a 30 million gallon plant in Brewster, Minnesota Soybean Processors. It's a full crush soybean plant, so they're using soybean oil exclusively. REG in Glenville, Albert Lea area, uses primarily soybean, but they also use other feedstock now, such as corn ethanol. They had a major retrofit a couple years ago where they could also process other oil stocks as well as soybean oil. And then we have a 3 million gallon plant up in Isanti, Evercat Fuels, which can use all types of oils, including used fryer oils and all different kinds of feedstock. Their process is a different process than our two larger plants, and their process is more tolerant of free fatty acid in the feedstock, so they can take a bit less pure feedstock at their plant. And that's all I have for the biodiesel report. If there's any further questions.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hennessy, we're, 5 years into this. What are the lessons learned?
Mr. Hennessy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I think we've proceeded slowly with the mandate, and that's been good. You know, the mandate was set to begin in 2012, and we weren't quite sure about blending in the southwest area of the state. We were concerned about the Department of Weights and Measures, their ability to track biodiesel blends throughout the state, and we took care of those and then implemented the mandate after that. And what we're seeing is, as we proceed very carefully, that things tend to work out much better.
Representative Hanson, or I'm sorry, Hamilton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that point, you know, with do you feel, and I think you've touched on this, some of the issues that we encountered early on, we've worked through those, the industry has worked through those, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, the biodiesel made today is much higher quality than it was in 2005. I mean, I've had tours of all the biodiesel plants since I started the job, and just the sampling, the cold temperature properties alone are very, very close to number two diesel, if not right on with number two diesel. And you know, it's really not fair to compare it to what it was when the mandate began at 2% back in 2005, or really when it was 5% began in 2009.
And you mentioned, Mr. Hennessy, that in the last year or so you've had no issues with the quality of biodiesel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we encourage people to call the diesel helpline with any diesel problems, but you know that includes potential biodiesel problems. We had a few calls last winter and went to them, but you know when it's 20 below, it's tough on all diesel fuel. So we put them in touch with the diesel helpline, and they're able to work with them on additives or blends with number one diesel that can get them through those really cold weeks.
Okay. Mr. Hennessy, you mentioned gasoline consumption is on the decline, and I've said for a long time that this country runs on diesel fuel. Do you have any numbers in terms of the usage of diesel fuel here in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I have recently been in contact with some people in Canada that have been looking at that, and the diesel fuel usage has been either going up slightly or going down slightly and very slightly in the state and our surrounding states, except for North Dakota in the last 5-6 years. So, it's going up rather than going down, like consistently down as gasoline has. So.
Okay. And maybe it's more of an infrastructure issue, but I know this fall again, and the terminals up around Alexandria, Fargo, and Grand Forks for a time had run out of diesel fuel, and then the trucks have to come down to the cities here, and it's kind of a effect that kind of multiplies itself. So there have been some issues with diesel fuel supply, but as you say, that consumption is fairly flat on a national or regional basis.
Mr. Chair, except for North Dakota, where you've got a lot of oil drilling and diesel necessary for what's going on up there.
So, okay.
I believe that does put a strain on our diesel supply here in Minnesota.
Okay. Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hennessy, are we prepared? Is the economy ready for the push to be 20 by 2018?
Good question, Mr. Hennessy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I tend to leave those questions to people who know more about it than I do, such as the diesel helpline. But from everything I hear, we are ready for B20. So I'll leave it at that.
Good answer. any further questions? Kind of a quiet group today. Anyway. Just to review then, you mentioned you're working with up to 40 stations, going back to E15 or E85, about 40 stations that either have E15 or will have E15 by, what, springtime or summer?
Right, Mr. Chair. Okay. That is correct.
How does that compare to our neighboring states?
Mr. Chair, we have been the leader in E85 stations for some time, and we continue to be the leader by at least, I believe, it's 60 stations over Iowa. So I see us as really we're moving in that direction again with this grant program, and we know what's required now as far as infrastructure and compatibility and what we need to move forward.
Okay. And you mentioned the amount of money that's been dispensed so far. In the governor's budget, is there additional funding for, I know the corn growers, I think, are still on board, but what about funding into the future for assistance with the station conversion?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the money that was appropriated was in the base, so I'd have to confirm that, but I believe that it's still there. The change items don't address it, but as I recall, it was part of our base budget.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sun. Any other questions? If not, thank you both very much. Report a very, very full in scope, and we thank you, Mr. Hennessy, for those reports this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We have a bill to address this morning, and as we get ready for that, House File 536. The main author is Chair Hamilton. Good morning. Would you like to move your bill, Mr. Chair?
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'd move that House File 536 be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
And any amendments to get the bill in the order that you would like?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have two amendments that I'd like to move initially before I start explaining the bill, if I could, please. The first one, if you'd refer to the A2 amendment, if I could move the A2 amendment, and just so everybody knows, it's my understanding what we're doing here is just inserting the words licensed under Chapter 326A, and this refers to the accountants. And actually, Mr. Chairman, I pulled the book out this morning and read up on that. And basically, it makes sure that the person is in good moral character, qualifications are in accordance with all the laws, rules, et cetera. So I don't think there's any controversy around this. So I would ask for your support.
Okay. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Amendment's approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next one I'd like to move is the A1 amendment. And Mr. Chairman, I'll just walk you through this. What we're wanting to do, we want to do this right. Everybody is in agreement with that. And what the A1 amendment will do is everybody who is eligible for this program must submit a responsible biomass sourcing plan to the commissioner prior to applying for the payments. And it lays everything out as far as what that plan would entail. And I would like to read through it because I believe it's important to the bill. And so it is a plan that will address how the agriculture's cellulosic biomass will be produced and managed in a way that preserves our soil qualities, does not increase soil and nutrient runoff, avoids introduction of harmful invasive species, limits negative impacts on wildlife habitat, and reduces greenhouse gas emission. And there's another provision in here, and I know there's a few on the committee that have talked to me about the importance of cover crops and perennials, et cetera. I'd like to refer you to line 1.12, and this is talks about discussing how new technologies and practices that are not yet commercially viable may be encouraged and adopted during the life of the facility, and how the producer will encourage continuous improvements during the life of this project, and includes specific numerical goals and timelines. And again, we want to encourage, like I said, other alternatives other than what's commonly practiced here, and I'll get even more into that when we start talking about the bill. So. Basically, you'll see that the language repeats itself three times to address the provisions in there about the advanced biofuels, about the renewed chemical, and the biomass thermal. And that's why you see it repeated three times, Mr. Chairman. I ask for your support.
Okay. Any other discussion on the A1 amendment? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hamilton. I just want to thank you for working with the folks on this, and I've been involved in these conversations, maybe not directly with you, but there's been a lot of conversation on this bill, and I think this is a significant improvement.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposition, same sign. Motion carries. Chair Hamilton, to your bill, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And I'll walk you through the bill here. And so, as I had said it stated earlier, this is creating an advanced biofuel production incentive program and addresses advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass production. And again, you'll see that repeated throughout the bill. And I think that just hitting on some of the highlights here, it talks about the perennial crops and the cover crops. And how does this work? Facilities who are eligible, if you would go to page 2.7, we can start there. A facility eligible for payments under this program must source at least 80% of the raw materials from Minnesota. We want this to be Minnesota-based products, right? But we also want to be aware that some of these may be located along the border states. And so we want to, again, encourage the product to be grown right here in Minnesota. And the raw materials must be a form of agriculture or forestry. We're working with our forestry friends as well, or from solid waste. And the production facility must be, again, located in Minnesota. We want this to be a Minnesota-based initiative. And, you know, the program itself, we're looking at 10 years. I do have testifiers here, Mr. Chair, that will explain why we do different calculations for the three different parts. I think that's important as well. And the other part that I want to talk about here, if you go to starting in line 2.24, an eligible facility producing advanced biofuels using agriculture cellulosic biomass is eligible for a 20% bonus payment for each BTU produced from agriculture biomass that is derived from perennial crops and from acres where cover crops are used. Again, we want to promote those other initiatives. I know there's members on this committee that are very passionate about, you know, having the cover crops, you know, the forever green and whatnot. We're wanting to design this and set it up that it'll encourage that. Mr. Chairman, I will be carrying another bill that will bring forward here additional dollars to invest in research that can help further that along as well. That we'll do that another day. The part about the forestry piece in here, we want to make sure that on the forestry side that they're following all the harvesting guidelines, whether they're the forestry piece or the brush or whatever, all the guidelines there. Again, we want to make sure that we're doing this right. And so we're working with follow the guidelines with the certified by the Forestry Stewardship Council, the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, the American Tree Farm Service, and et cetera. Because, again, we want to make sure we're doing this right, and we're trying to bring all stakeholders to the table the best that we possibly can. With that, Mr. Chairman, I do have some testifiers that can help explain this even a little bit better and answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our first testifier at the table, good morning, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Brendan Jordan. I'm a vice president with the Great Plains Institute, and I serve as a facilitator and organizer for the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota. The Bioeconomy Coalition is a multi-stakeholder group representing agriculture, forestry, startup companies, established industry, environmental community, and other groups. The mission of the coalition is to expand Minnesota's renewable chemical, advanced biofuel, and biomass thermal energy industries in the state. I'm here this morning to provide a little bit of a walkthrough for House File 536. Representative Hamilton has covered some of the elements of the program, but I'll just want to talk a little bit about the mechanics of how this would work. It is a production-based incentive, which means that this is a program that rewards production of fuels, chemicals, and biomass thermal. It does not make upfront payments, so it is really a performance-based incentive that rewards successful projects. Eligibility for the program is limited to only advanced biofuels, meeting the EPA definition meeting the carbon reduction requirements under EPA rules, renewable chemicals, which are basically chemicals that displace petroleum-based chemicals, and biomass thermal energy, which is typically a medium to large scale project using biomass, often in many cases forestry biomass, as a source of heat, which could be directed in areas of the state that are dependent on propane, not part of the natural gas system, where there is a lot of interest in diversifying fuel mix. House File 536 is divided into three sections along those lines, those three categories. Eligibility for the program is determined in part by start date. A facility would have to come online on July 1st, 2015 or later, and would have until July 30th, 2025 to start production. Each facility would receive an incentive program over a 10-year period. Eligible facilities could be an existing plant where there was some reinvestment or a new facility. There are minimum production levels established. It is intended to reward commercial scale production. So minimum production levels are laid out in the bill. And there are also caps at the top end for the level of production as well in each of the three categories. The program also establishes caps on the overall size of the program and the number of facilities that could qualify. To provide a little more detail, in the advanced biofuel category, essentially the payment is $2 per MMBTU, per million BTU, translating that into terms that are more understandable. It's roughly 20 cents per gallon for a cellulosic-based biofuel, an advanced biofuel, or 10 cents per gallon for an advanced biofuel that is not derived from biomass. In the renewable chemical section, it's up to 6 cents per pound for cellulose-derived renewable chemicals and 3 cents per pound for sugar-derived renewable chemicals. The biomass thermal section is a $5 per MMBTU incentive, awarding up to 30,000 MMBTU of biomass thermal energy production. Representative Hamilton has walked through the sustainability provisions in the program. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair and members, to discuss this bill. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Jordan. Questions from members? If not, thank you much. I'm sorry. Representative Bly.
This actually may not be a question for the testifier. I'm curious, I guess, with what could be a positive environmental impact of this. I'm just wondering, should the bill have gone first to environmental policy before it came to ag policy, or maybe it should go there before it gets to ag finance? I'm just curious to know.
Representative or Chair Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Bly, of course, we're going to respect the other committees and the other chair's wishes. It was sent to this committee. We'll work with Chair McNamara, if there's any, if he, you know, and the committee, I guess, if Chair McNamara would ask for it. I guess I don't have any concerns. I'm passionate about this, and I believe in it. But as it states right now, it's going to ag finance because we got to work out the finance side of this as well.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Hamilton. I appreciate that.
And conferring with staff, Representative McNamara's people were contacted, and they felt that it did not need to go to their committee, or at least didn't express the opinion that it should go to their committee.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I thought it would be helpful. It was extremely helpful for me to actually see what it is that we're trying to get accomplished. With your permission, I do have some products here that I can display up here, if that's okay.
So it's not treats?
No, well, I know, if you want to open them up, you know. So what we're doing, folks, is these are items that impact our daily lives, right? They impact our daily lives, and it's displacing existing use of fossil fuels. And we're wanting to do this right here in the state of Minnesota. And if you look at look across the world as far as the economic benefit, you do have handouts in your folders here as far as what this is going to do. Worldwide advanced biofuels market will be over $185 billion by 2021. And we want to be leaders right here in Minnesota. What are we talking about? We're talking about developing products such as this. Make sure they put money in the coffee fund. So we're talking about, you know, the bottles, right? The bottles that are manufactured. Nail polish remover. I don't use this, but, well, but I don't judge either. Laundry detergent, you know, bottles around that. You're looking at, what's this? Paints.
So are you talking about the containers or the stuff inside the containers, Chair Hamilton?
Well, in some cases, both, Mr.
Chair. Yeah, okay.
In some cases, both, you know. And so it's daily products that we can either make the containers or, in some cases, the items within the containers, right? And so that's what we're wanting to do here. With Minnesota grown, at least 80% of it, in Minnesota plants, that will, like I said earlier, impact our lives daily and displace existing use of fossil fuels. So this is an exciting initiative, and we have companies right here that are willing to do that, or they're exploring the opportunity to do it right here. So,
excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we do have some other testifiers. If no more questions for him.
Bridget Tuck. Hey. Good morning, ma'am.
You can pull these down.
Good morning.
You may want to remove the Samsung there, but anyway.
We'll take the Samsung.
Good morning.
State your name.
My name is Bridget Tuck. I am the Senior Economic Impact Analyst for University of Minnesota Extension. For those of you who know Extension, we are the outreach arm of the university. And in particular, I work in the area of community economics. So our goal and our mission is to help communities make decisions using data, economic data. And that's my mission that brings me here today. The Great Plains Institute was interested in understanding a little bit more about how the potential bio-based industrial products facilities would affect the economy of the state of Minnesota. And I conducted that research and had the analysis. You should have the full report in your packet. It looks a little bit like this. And I'm going to talk primarily from the executive summary, which is on page one, if you kind of want to follow along with that. But I encourage you, if you're interested in sort of the details of the analysis, to read the entire report. So what the Great Plains Institute asks us to do is to look at the potential economic impact if there were 14 new facilities developed in Minnesota. So we had seven, the Great Plains Institute identified seven companies that are currently looking to locate in Minnesota and open these kinds of facilities. And so based on those seven companies, I was able to collect their data about what their expenditures would be in the state. And then we replicated that up to be 14. So we have seven actual case studies. We looked at some facilities might, you know, there might be two or three of them potentially in Minnesota. Some of them, there might only be one. And then we use that to design these 14. So based on that, if those 14 facilities were to be at full operation, which would likely be a couple years into operation, they would spend $470.3 million in the state of Minnesota. Of that, $36.8 million would be for labor income, so that's money directly into the pockets of the residents of the state of Minnesota, and the facilities themselves would employ 590 people. Now, as we know, when companies spend money in the state, they create ripple effects. I heard you mention that they would 80% of the feedstocks would be from the state of Minnesota. So those create impacts in other industries in Minnesota. So in total, the economic contribution would be an estimated $837.6 million, and that's on an annual basis. And that would include $174.1 million of labor income, wages, salaries, and benefits. And the industry would support 3,190 jobs in the state of Minnesota. Now, it's instructive to have that big number, but it's also interesting to look at where those ripple effects would be. So what are the industries that would benefit most? So we looked at feedstock costs, generally run somewhere to 75 to 90% of the cost of these facilities. So you would, not surprisingly, you see big impacts in the industries that provide those feedstocks. And since we looked at both wood and timber as a feedstock and then corn as a feedstock, we see about, our model is predicting about 900 logging jobs would be necessary to support that feedstock input. And then about 500 grain farming operations would provide some of their grain into the production process and would receive some of their farm income then from these facilities. We also looked at, one of the companies is headquartered here in Minnesota, so we did see some large impacts in the area of research and development as well. So these are the ongoing impacts that we would see, as I said, annually during the, as long as those facilities were operational. We would also see some construction impacts. So during the construction phase, which would not all occur in 1 year, and it wouldn't all occur, you know, at one time, but over the period would create $1.5 billion in economic activity in the state. That includes $538.2 million of labor income and would support 8,690 jobs in the state of Minnesota. I just want to clarify, too, that University of Minnesota Extension focused on the economic contribution, and we did not do a feasibility analysis related to these facilities. So that's the information I have today for you, a quick summary. I'm happy to take questions.
Some pretty impressive numbers. They really are. Questions from the committee. Vice Chair Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, just more of a comment. I can't wait till we are discussing industrial hemp as a biomass as well. Just wanted to add that on there.
I knew that was coming. And just to be clear, when you mentioned grain farmers, 500 grain farms, we're talking the stover left over, not the actual corn grain, correct?
Mr. Chair, no. So we would be looking. We looked at corn itself as a as an input, as well as corn stover.
Okay.
We actually didn't model because if corn stover is a byproduct of corn production. So we didn't actually model any additional sort of corn production related to corn stover. What we modeled was an increase in farm income because farmers would be receiving additional income off a product they already produced.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions,
Mr. Chairman? No, I'm sorry.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure who would best answer this question. This was a question offered me by a farmer that came to my office yesterday when I asked him what he thought about this move. And he was concerned about the move from ethanol production, actually, towards this. I actually think cellulosic is a good option. But what he said was a byproduct of ethanol production is DDG, a high-grade feed for farmers. What would be the change in the availability of that feed if we're moving away from ethanol production, or are you suggesting that? I'm just wondering what the answer to that question might be.
Chair Hamilton or Ms. Scott?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have some other testifiers that may be able to answer that directly as well. However, my personal opinion, and I will want to back that up, is I don't think it'll impact the DDGs at all because you'll still have that for a feed byproduct. We're talking about, you know, when we're manufacturing ethanol, obviously, as we all know, you have the DDGs, the dried distiller grains that you can use for livestock feed, et cetera. And I would like others to back this up, but I don't think that will be interrupted at all by going towards this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tuck. Next up, I believe it's Larry Novikoski. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Good morning. My name is Larry Novikoski from Little Falls, Minnesota, Morrison County, about the center of the state. And remind me about that question about distillers grain, and I can answer that a little bit later in my presentation.
Thank you.
I'm currently an employee of Central Minnesota Renewables, and I believe there's a handout in your packet. I won't refer to a lot of the data on there, but it would be important to look at that. One of the products, or a number of the products on the table earlier, are certainly a piece of what's going to be made at our facility. In addition, one other housekeeping item, I believe you do have a letter of support in your packet from the Minnesota Biofuels Association We're currently a member of that group and certainly support the work that they do. A little background, I grew up on a all-purpose farm in Little Falls, near Little Falls, and in the mid-90s I was part of the original board that developed the plan to build and construct the Central Minnesota Ethanol Co-op. We're a 20 million gallon facility, began production in 1999 and continued production through when the plant was actually sold in December to Central Minnesota Renewables. Originally, we had about 800 co-op members in our organization, over half of those farmers, and the other half community members that recognize the importance of having that production facility in our community. About 3 years ago, our board and management team looked at the long-term viability of a plant or a first-generation ethanol plant or not nearly as large as most of the plants in the state and how we could survive long-term. The board and management team agreed we should look for a partner, somebody that would repurpose our facility to do the things that we've done in the community, provide a market for corn. We use about 7.5 million bushels of corn in our area. We think it probably impacts in the range of 10 to 20 cents a bushel by having that demand for that product there versus trucking it to Minneapolis or to the river or Duluth or wherever. We create 30 plus jobs in the community and a tax base, property tax base. So as we looked at a number of different partners, CMR came to the forefront. Green Biologics is the parent company, and their goal was to repurpose our facility to make a bio-based chemical, which is butanol and acetone. And butanol is a building block for many of the things you saw on the table here, paints, adhesive, inks, toners, and so on. A worldwide demand for that product. Certainly, regionally, many companies that use those products and paints and so on. So we thought it was a good fit and ultimately came to an agreement to transfer ownership to the Central Minnesota Renewables. Long-term, this bill, and we certainly are here to hoping for your support on that bill, helps the initial financing of that bill or of that plant and production longer term to enter the market. Certainly we're competing with the oil companies, and as we all know from the ethanol side of things, they kind of have a stranglehold on the market and what we get for our products. So we think it's going to be difficult those early years of production to gain a foothold in that market. Long term, we think it's going to be strong because it's bio-based. The companies that will buy this product can put green on their can or from renewable resources, and we think it's going to be beneficial long term. However, recognizing that the greatest economic threat will happen in those early years. The other thing that's important is it'll keep the demand, as I mentioned earlier, for that corn growing in our area. Long term, as I mentioned earlier, many of our current shareholders have decided to reinvest into the new company. About $6 million worth, or about 25 to 30% of our current shareholders in the ethanol co-op have decided to reinvest in the new company. So they recognize the importance for our local community to maintain that production facility, the employment, and the tax base. And your question, Representative, earlier about distillers grain, will produce a product about the same amount. It'll be more like a wet milling plant. It won't be distilled grain, but it'll be like a feed gluten. About the same type of product, distillers grain, the same amount. So using corn for this product will not impact the availability of an alternative feed source for the swine, dairy, and hog producers of our area. So I want to again thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from members? That's an exciting story. Good luck with it.
And Mr. Yeah. Chairman, I just want to thank Testfire for clarifying the whole DDG piece. So thank you.
Next testifier from the corn growers. Good morning, and identify yourself.
Anna Boroff, the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of the Corn Growers Association, over 7,100 members, I'm here today to support the bill and thank not only Representative Hamilton for carrying it this session, but Chairwoman Poppe, you've carried it in the past, last year while we were still working out some of the issues, so thank you for doing that. This legislation was brought to us in what I see as the best possible way, which is a very passionate farmer from Carver County brought it to our attention. He was really excited about it. He brought it before, I think it's like 150 of his fellow corn farmer peers at our annual meeting, explained to him what the concept was and kind of garnered their support. And we've been engaged in the project ever since with the Bioeconomy Coalition, thanks to Brendan and Amanda for all their work on that. The coalition is a diverse one. The work hasn't always been easy. We've had a lot of things to think about over the last couple of years, but I know it's been a tremendous opportunity for us, and so we're so grateful to be able to support the bill today. So, at Minnesota Corn, our farmers, we pride ourselves on kind of thinking outside of the box. That's the way we've been since we were founded. It's made us a pioneer in the ethanol industry, which we're very proud of. It keeps us focused on new opportunities for corn and for sharing our love for farming with policymakers like yourself. Today, I'm here to support the current bill that's in front of us to talk about advanced biofuels, biomass, thermal, and renewable chemicals. You know, our farmers are used to a concept sort of like this, so they understood when it was being explained to them. It's a very similar model to the way we built the ethanol industry in the 1980s. And to make sure that it had an opportunity to compete fairly in the marketplace, like the last testifier explained. Lenders needed the security to invest in what was new technology at the time, and the producer payment provided that peace of mind with little risk for the state. Obviously, the ethanol industry has had a huge impact on our state, to our rural communities, and our lives of our farmers. And the concept worked. We no longer receive production payments, and the industry now contributes $5 billion to our economy and about 12,000 jobs. So now we have a new opportunity. This proposal could make us competitive in another new industry, adding lots more jobs, new opportunities for farmers. We've talked a little bit about the raw materials for these industries, specifically corn stover. We have a large we have large quantities of it in Minnesota that could be sustainably harvested. I think the numbers we've seen are about 15 million tons. The costs are relatively low to harvest and transport it, and our farmers are already used to doing that sustainably. They use it as feed and bedding for livestock currently. So we believe that adding to the market for stover would add some value for farmers, especially as we're looking at kind of buckling in for the next few years. That could be really rough for farmers, especially when corn prices are below the cost of production. So anything we could do to kind of help them out in that regard would be much appreciated. So thank you. So on behalf of our members, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for carrying the bill. And I'd answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Borup. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, I would just say thank you to the corn growers for your support of some of the programs that you get behind and provide support financially, and we just want to say thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next testifier, I believe, is from the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Busselman. I'm with the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau supports the development of the advanced biofuels, and we believe that the incentive-driven approach provided in this proposed legislation will responsibly achieve that outcome. Beyond the merits of opening opportunities for residue resources, there is also some value-added incentives for renewable chemical production. We also think that it is a positive move to include in this bill the use of forest products and biomass in this comprehensive program. We support the bill and encourage you to do so, too.
Thanks, Mr. Busselman. Any questions? If not, thank you. Next up, Sean Schottler. I didn't butcher the name too badly. Okay. Welcome to our committee, and come on down and have a chair. And okay. Now, that doesn't look like treats. Okay.
One for Republican members and one for Democrats.
Okay.
Bipartisan.
Thanks. Good morning.
Thank you.
Identify yourself, please.
My name is Sean Schottler. I'm a research scientist with the Science Museum of Minnesota at their field research station, the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'll tell you why I'm involved in this. My principal area of research is trying to understand the things that change water quality and, to some extent, habitat, positively or negatively, both in the past and going forward into the future. Which is why I got involved in the cellulosic ethanol, because it has the potential to change things positively or negatively very large. The current cellulosic mandate is 16 billion gallons. That's larger than the existing grain mandate for ethanol. So whatever happens with this, the potential to impact the landscape is very large. It's often perceived that corn cobs, corn leaves, and corn stalks are an unused waste product. They are not a waste product. Corn stover is organic matter, it is stored nutrients, and it prevents soil erosion. The research that's been done to indicate sustainable harvest of the stover at best shows no negative impact to water quality. At best, no negative impact. And that's if the guidelines are followed and if the science around those is correct. And there's quite a bit of data existing, especially on soil health, soil organic matter, that the even 50% harvesting of stover will have a negative impact on water quality. Even if the impact is small, the fact that we could be harvesting stover from 80 million acres, which is what it would take to meet the mandate, the landscape scale is very large. The risk to using stover is high. I am not against cellulosic ethanol. In fact, I think there's a real opportunity here. It's the feedstock that we choose, and that's what I passed around. We have the technology, it exists, at both the Poet plant and the DuPont plant in Iowa, to use a variety of things, including alfalfa. Alfalfa is a known crop, it's insured, and it has some real benefits. The stems that it shows in the bag are the cellulosic feedstock. The leaves are basically the equivalent of the distiller's grains, that's the livestock feed that's stripped off, high in protein. You get two crops from it. Because you harvest it for cellulosic source, the harvest date is mid-June, which means you get the first flush of nesting ducks and pheasants. That's a boon to the sportsman's economy. And it's a flowering plant for pollinators, all pluses. In addition, one of the magics about ethanol, or about alfalfa, is in rotation with corn, it gives you roughly 150 pounds to the acre credit nitrogen, which means 1 out of 3 years in your corn rotation, you don't have to apply nitrogen, which means we get a nitrate reduction in our waters. It's a win-win-win all the way around for the alfalfa. Again, I'm not saying we shouldn't do cellulosic ethanol. What I'm questioning is the feedstock, and it seems that an incentive for something that provides us multiple benefits and still gets us the greenhouse gas reductions as well as all of the products that we can make from it is a big plus. Thank you.
Any comments or questions? Mr. Schottler, maybe. Oh, Representative Bly.
Thank you. Well, you've kind of hit on the thing that troubles me about this proposal. I too support cellulosic development, and I think the first time I heard talk of this bill, I asked, "Well, how will this affect our water? And can you assure that we're going to be taking care of our water if we are doing this?" And I didn't really get a good answer to my question, but I think what we're struggling with this bill is how do we jumpstart the cellulosic production, and some would argue that you use available crop or materials that are there and get started with that, and then shift over to other materials. And how difficult would it be to move to alfalfa, as you're suggesting? And is it something that farmers who are traditionally growing a lot of corn could move into, or how workable is what you're suggesting?
Mr. Schottler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bly. I also farm 320 acres with my family. All of us farmers in the area, and I'm sure throughout Minnesota, remember growing alfalfa as kids. The technology to grow it is there. We're familiar with that. The ability to strip the leaves and separate it from the stems, that's a place that needs an incentive. In regards to how easily could we shift, are you familiar with when you drive through Wisconsin, you come near Toma, and you're on I-90, and I-90 and 94 split? And once you take that split and you're on 94, it's darn hard to get back on I-90. When we choose one path and we go down that path and we build for it, it will be exceedingly difficult, particularly if we don't incentivize the alternative feedstocks to go in another direction. In addition, I would say the cellulosic mandate exists at 16 billion gallons. Corn stover exists on every field we grow corn. The plants that are currently processing stover exist. The part that doesn't exist right now is a significant incentive for the alternative feedstocks.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is the beauty about this program. The absolute beauty about this program. First of all, I like the fact that all stakeholders are coming up and testifying on this. And if you take a look at the bill itself, it does encourage. It has an additional bump in here of 20% bonus payments for each BTU produced from biomass that's derived from perennial crops and for cover crops. And the other thing, like we said, when we're talking about the other bill that I'm going to be bringing forward here, to invest into research, to accomplish some of these things that the testifier is bringing up here as well, it's a win-win for all of us. And yes, we do have to start somewhere. We're not. Otherwise, we're going to stifle this industry. We'll stifle the ability to get out ahead of this, and this is going to be a huge economic boom to the industry. What's the alternative? You want to talk about water quality? What's the alternative? Continue building these from petroleum-based? These are things that everybody use daily, even the people that will step up here and oppose the bill. They use this every single day of their lives. What we're saying is we have a bill that will jumpstart this, and we will continue to work with all stakeholders. We'll continue to do the research when it comes to cover crops and perennials. We'll continue to look for alternatives that will benefit everybody, not only the individuals on one side that talk specifically for the environment, but we're also going to benefit the farmer, the producer, the individuals that are trying to make a living on the land and do it in a very responsible way. It's a win-win for everybody. And I ask yourself, to anybody, if they oppose it, what is the alternative? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Schottler, I just have one last question for you, and this is kind of you're a soils guy. And I've been told that some of these new processes for collecting stover coming out the back of the combine, they get most of the cob and not as much of the actual stock and leaves, that thing, kind of thing. And that when the corn cob decomposes, it actually takes more nutrients to decompose the cob, so it itself has almost a negative impact on soil fertility. Is that correct, or could you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I'll say that is correct on the face of it. It depends on the carbon to nitrogen ratio. So it depends on how much biomass is out there in the field and what you're trying to grow the following year. There's a lot of nitrogen tucked away in corn leaves, corn stalks, wherever, that is used the following year. It also takes some nitrogen to actually make that nitrogen that's in those leaves available, which is why they've set the harvest guidelines at 50% of the biomass if your yields are over, I think it's 180 bushels to the acre, because that equates to a certain amount of biomass. That is incentivizing a producer then who's at 170 bushels to the acre to apply more nitrogen so that he can increase his biomass in order to get to a higher rate, you're going to lose some nitrogen every time you increase your application rate. There is a very high risk here that as we're incentivizing more biomass, we're going to have more nitrate in our surface and groundwaters. It just works out that way. At best, it would be neutral.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know what? The other thing that research will tell you is that regardless whether or not we use nitrogen on the corn crop, we utilize the nutrients within that soil about 5 months out of the year. And so that's where working with Representative Johnson, Representative Bly, the University of Minnesota, and others, we're looking for these alternatives. Yes, we need corn, and I'll stand here and I'll defend corn till the day I die. We do need that. There's value there. But with the work of others, we can come up with some of these other solutions for the, like we said, for evergreen, cover crops, whatever, that is profitable for the farmer as well, but also has positive environmental impacts. So we can do this. We can do this, but we have to start somewhere. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, may I have a comment?
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Schottler.
And I'll just make all of you aware that you're going to increasingly hear this over and over in water quality issues, that the thing that has become overwhelmingly apparent to those of us working on water quality is that we probably cannot meet the water quality standards that we have set given the current technologies and practices in which we're utilizing the landscape, which is primarily corn and soybeans. We need to introduce other crops onto the landscape. And that's where we're short, is what are the markets for those other crops, what are their incentives, and the ability to use cellulosic ethanol is a huge incentive to do other crops if we do it.
Thank you. Vice Chair Franson has an answer to that.
Yeah.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Hamilton, I appreciate your mentioning of the efforts that Representative Johnson and I have made, and you know, hope you understand that in theory, you know, I really hope we move forward with cellulosic, and I think you're absolutely right that it's good in a lot of ways. I do share the testifier's concern about moving off of corn and onto these other products. I'm wondering if there's a way to, and maybe you've already thought of this, I don't know, but to have whatever incentives you want for the corn stover, to have that decrease, you know, so that we move quickly into trying to incentivize these other the other crops. Is that something that you would entertain talking about?
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is the beauty of all this, because quite frankly, I've said this before, I want it all, guys. And, you know, we have to double the world's food supply in 35 short years. I'll be dead and gone, but my children hopefully will still be around, and my grandchildren, right? And we want to do it in an environmentally sensitive way. You know what? I keep going back to that quote that we did not inherit this earth from our parents. We're borrowing it from our children. And so by working with individuals, and if I use the terminology people who oppose some of the initiatives that we're trying to do, it's not the fact that you oppose it. You and Representative Johnson and others, you're simply standing up for what you believe in, and you make us better. You make everybody better. We make each other better. The whole thing is, the point that I absolutely want to stress here is that for whatever reason in agriculture, it is looked down upon if you make money in agriculture. Everybody else can make money on this planet, but for some reason you can't in ag. And quite frankly, if you want to farm and not make any money at doing it, there's a word for it. It's called gardening, right? The thing is, but we can do it in an environmentally sensitive way, and we can get, and we are getting smarter and smarter and smarter as we go. We're not utilizing the same practices we did back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, etc., because we continue to get smarter. And the whole thing is, what we have to do, we must do, and I've spoke with Representative Johnson. I'm singling you two guys out. I have a tremendous amount of respect, and we've had a great deal of conversation around this, and that's why I do it. What we must do is, along this, we must invest in research as well. If you take a look at the research that Norman E. Borlaug did, he is credited with saving more lives than anybody else in the history of mankind through the Green Revolution, right? That's great work.
if you take a look, while we're investing in things in the universities, land-grant universities and everything else, we can do it in a much better way. And productivity will go up along with that, right? If we do not invest in research, it is shown, in whether it's cereals or whatever, where productivity will go down. But by having these conversations, Representative Bly, by having individuals on all sides, from every end of the spectrum, if you will, we can make this better. And again, I ask you, what is the alternative? If we don't jumpstart this, if we don't get going, Representative Poppy, she recognized that, and she introduced the bill early on. If we don't jumpstart this and start somewhere, we're going to miss out. But we can do it in a sensible way by having these conversations so that we can establish the best management practices along the way.
Representative Bly, follow up.
Thank you. First of all, I guess I want to be clear that I don't begrudge farmers making a profit or making a decent living off the land, and want to do that. I think what we've learned over time, and even looking at the Green Revolution, that there are times when practices that are the result of biotechnology or whatever can sometimes do more harm than good. And even though they may lead to producing more food products, the environmental degradation across the world even is concerning. And I agree wholeheartedly we need to continue to have these conversations where we talk through this, because I don't think the Green Revolution is a clear path to feeding the world. I think that there's room for conversation about how to do that in a really positive way. Also, you know, helping other nations develop ways that they can produce their own food and foods that are healthy for them. And so I welcome the opportunity to discuss it, and I hope we can continue the discussion as we go forward. As I said, I certainly support research. We've talked about some other kinds of research that I'd like to see go forward, and you've been supportive of that, and I really appreciate that. And I think we need to continue the conversation and be open-minded to both sides to go forward. So thank you very much.
Thank Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps this is the time for me to move my amendment. It's the A-15.
We have a couple of testifiers left, okay? Could you hold off just
yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schottler, for your testimony.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And Steve Morris is also coming on down to testify. Welcome, and please identify yourself.
Good morning. Steve Morris with the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We are the state's largest environmental conservation coalition with 70-plus organizations that are actively engaged on a suite of issues. And, you know, I'm going to take just a minute. I'm going to be very brief. I just want to give a little personal perspective because there are so many new members. I served in the Senate from 86 to 99. I was here in 1986 and one of the early supporters of our original ethanol program. We structured this facility incentive. I served on the Ag Committee. We passed it in the late 80s. Senator Frederickson, now Commissioner Frederickson, was the lead author. We came in together as colleagues. Through the 90s, I served as the Senate Environment and Ag Chair for most of the 90s, starting in 91 to 99, and was a consistent champion of the ethanol industry that we have in place because I thought it really made sense to diversify our fuel mix. But as I've come to learn more and moved on to other positions, what I've learned is that, I think as Representative Hamilton said it very eloquently, we're not going to get to the core of our water quality issues if we continue to rely on the cropping systems that we have. He said we have active crops in the landscape for about 5 months out of the year. The problem is the other 7 months out of the year, we don't have the roots that are absorbing the water, that are using the nutrients, and that creates a lot of water quality issues for us. Whether it be phosphorus, silt, or nitrogen in our waters, we have a very steep hill to climb in order to meet and get to our water quality goals. We simply can't do it without new strategy, as Mr. Schottler said. For example, we have a 45% nitrogen reduction goal in the MPCA's nutrient reduction strategy. The agency estimates that in order to get there, more than half of that reduction is going to have to come from putting perennials and cover crops into our cropping mix. In fact, that's true for, it's a major strategy for phosphorus, for silt, for sediment, whatever. I'm very happy to see, to hear Senator Representative Hamilton's comments about, yes, we need to figure these systems out. We totally agree. We think it's a tremendous opportunity to move beyond the regulatory approach. Water quality standards are really important. How we manage our crops are really important. But these non-regulatory, market-driven strategies probably offer us the best opportunity to improve our water quality in a way that is profitable and successful for agriculture. And so I think there's a lot of commonality on the direction of things here and the opportunities. It's really about using crops to clean up our water, to provide the habitat, to provide some pollinators and other services while still providing a profitable economic system. Cellulosic ethanol represents a major expansion for the ethanol industry in the state. And what that means is we are missing a major opportunity if we do not focus this expansion on providing more options for farmers, and we hear this from our farm-aligned groups who are hearing it in their township halls and their meetings across the state. The farmers are looking for more cropping options. So we need to provide, help incentivize those options that will provide options for farmers and also provide the most benefits for the state. By using perennial fuels in these new facilities, we can build soil health, improve water storage capacity of the soil, dramatically improve water quality, provide habitat and wildlife, non-game, game, pollinators, you name it, and also, which has barely been mentioned, maybe Sean mentioned it, forage for livestock. So our concern, and I'll be brief here and be happy to answer any question, we do not support the bill as it's drafted. We appreciate the comments and the discussions that Representative Hamilton is interested, or says he's interested in having. We think the alternative is to put a program that provides incentives for the perennial side of the equation. We have to make sure that we move wholeheartedly to the perennial side. These biofacilities, these biofuel facilities are not going to happen quickly. They're not going to happen overnight. And what we'd really like to see is some sort of feedstock incentive program or some sort of requirement beyond the 20%. We appreciate that, but we don't think it gets there. But we really need to focus this emerging industry on the perennials. And although it might not be corn and it might not be soybeans, what it does is it addresses one of the major issues for our corn and soybean industry and growers in the state. And that is, it's a way that we can address the water quality issues so corn and beans can be grown on other acres, but we really need to find a way to bring more diversity into the landscape. So without that clear roadmap in the bill, we cannot support this as a coalition. We're happy to work with the author as well as GPI, Great Plains Institute, to continue to refine this because there may be a way to thread this needle and get it done. But I will tell you that back in the 80s, again, to bring it full circle and part of my evolution, we talked a lot at that time about ethanol being from things other than grain, the corn, kernel corn, other than the grain. And we incentivized some other crops, but you know, didn't do it wholeheartedly and didn't really have a clear path of how to get there. And what happened is we started on corn, we have the technology, we have the infrastructure, we understand that, we get that, and that's where we ended up and that's where it's been. And we want to make sure that in this next generation, we're a little smarter. We've evolved beyond our thinking from the 80s, and we're a little smarter in thinking about how we can build systems that have multiple benefits, and we're very committed to that and can't support this good concept without those provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Any questions from members? Representative Hamilton.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll just once again just remind the testifier that there is a provision in there to encourage this along the way. We have to start somewhere. We can limp this thing along and not even bring it to fruition and miss a huge opportunity here. And so, again, what's the alternative? What is the alternative? And, you know, one of my favorite, I'm not going to go there yet. I'll save that for later. But you know what? The alternative, if we don't get started and we don't do this, we're still going to be extremely reliant on others. We have an opportunity here. And all the stakeholders that I've been talking to, except for maybe one, have all agreed that we're going to continue working together on this to where we can get accomplished what it is that we want to get accomplished. But we must start somewhere as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Representative Johnson, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A15 amendment.
Could you please explain that amendment, Representative?
I will try. Basically, what the amendment does is require that 50% of the production receiving payments under the bill would come from that are made from agriculture products would come from perennials. Okay? And then I'd like to speak to it a little bit. Okay?
Okay.
Good. I want to, Representative Hamilton, you said you're looking for an alternative. I'm going to suggest this is an alternative. And I want to also start by saying I share your deep respect for and the fundamental basic understanding that we need to make money in farm country. I proudly represent Nicollet County. I am proud that the farmers in my county make a good living. I want to see them continue doing that. I believe strongly that that impacts my hometown of North Mankato and Mankato, and that's central to my work in the legislature, and I think you know that. And I'm thinking there's some opportunity here. So anyway, so this would place 50% towards perennials, but certainly allow for the 50% towards the corn stover. And actually, I agree with the testifier, Ms. Boroff, that this does, especially as we're watching the price of corn decline, this does offer an opportunity for additional income for the corn growers in my district, and I think that's valuable and important. But I also want to pick up on your comment where you said we want to be leaders, and I think we have an opportunity here to be leaders. And it's an opportunity, really, for Minnesota to encourage the use of perennials, and I'm going to also mention the forest industry at this time as well, to encourage that and to do this a little different than what we're seeing to our neighbors in the South, and to do it well. I like the comment, do it right. That's a comment that I hear often in my county on many issues. Let's do it right. And I think we want to do this right. I thought it was interesting that Mr. Schottler shared the alfalfa. I am deeply interested in alfalfa and in expanding the production of alfalfa in Minnesota. And just a couple of weeks ago, I learned that two of the very major dairies in this state are importing alfalfa from other states. And then when I asked, well, would you rather buy local alfalfa, they said, sure. And I think this is an opportunity to do that. We need to create markets for alfalfa, and if we can do that, I agree with Mr. Schottler, and I think it's pretty clear. And you talk to farmers, I'm old enough to remember when alfalfa was part of the rotation. And my wife, who grew up on a farm in western North Dakota, you start talking about alfalfa with her, she gets a wry smile on her face because it's an endeared crop, and there's a lot of value to the crop. And I don't want to just focus on alfalfa, but I think we want to focus on perennials and the forest products. I believe that state investment can impact and speed up change. And I think in many ways, I don't know the history of the ethanol industry that well, but I think you could make the case that investment sped up and changed a lot of how we do farming. And I think you can see it with just a number of things. We're seeing it actually right now with the And I don't want, at the risk of bringing in another issue, but the point I'm trying to make is state investment can make change. And I think we're seeing it in the decline of the cost of solar, where the state has encouraged investment of that. So it builds the viability of that. Now, the way this is drafted, I'm not so sure it's ready right now. I think one of the things I've recognized is that this effort of shifting the support from corn and stover to the perennials and to the forest industry may be best phased in. And we could talk about that, and this bill has a little ways to go. But I think it is that opportunity we're talking about. I also want to just briefly pick up on the forest products as well. I know the amendment deals with the ag land, but I don't know if members of this committee know, I have a small tree farm up in Meadow Township of Wadena County, which is just south of Huntersville State Forest, where just north of there is where we're seeing a lot of the shift from pines to potatoes. And I don't want to get into that issue, except to say that I know as a tree farmer that I'm concerned about the market for my trees. I grow timber, and of course some of that goes to pulp. And I think we have a long-term issue in northern Minnesota with respect to our forests and our trees. We've got a lot of managed trees up there. We do it well, and I'm proud to be part of that. But I'm concerned about the long-term market on this. This, again, is an opportunity both to promote that industry and then also, again, to promote the use of perennials. So I'm not going to ask for a vote on this amendment today. But I am going to ask that I want to be involved with conversations with the Great Plains Institute, Representative Hamilton, and I want to give a plug to the Great Plains Institute. I really appreciate the steady work that, in her case, Amanda Billick has been consistently communicating very well with me, and I want to keep that continuation communication going. But my goal is by the time that this bill hits the Finance Committee, I want to see a way to try to find a way to phase out the payments towards the corn stover and to embody in that bill the ability to then increase the payments towards the forestry products and the perennials. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative, are you withdrawing the amendment?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Johnson. And, you know, I'll continue working with you as well. And I keep coming back to this. One of the question I would have had for you is, you know, how quickly could we do this? And, you know, and again, what would be, when the economics comes into it as well, what would be the incentive there? And so we do have some work to do around all that. We have to have these conversations. And then that's the other piece. I want the research to back this up too, right? And so there's going to be another component there because I really appreciate these conversations that we continue having because, like I said, it makes us all better. And so, again, thank you for your comments. Thank you for withdrawing it here today, and I'll continue working with you on that.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton. I think you raised a good question, and we can address this today. I guess what is the impact of that 20% incentive? And I'm not so sure we know that. I think obviously my thought is that I'm concerned that just is not a significant incentive that will assure that we get to the point where I'm trying to get. And whereas some sort of a phasing out and then a phasing in, I think would be beneficial. So again, this demands a longer conversation, but I've got time for that conversation. I look forward to it.
Okay. I see the clock is ticking on the wall. Anybody in the audience wish to testify either for or against this bill? See none. From the committee members, any further discussion on House File 536 as amended? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I very much appreciate that you've brought forth this bill again this year. I think one of the keys is the coalition, the fact that this is a diverse coalition, and they have taken great strides in getting this right, trying to do as much as they could do to, and if you think about it, if you look at this list, you know, the Bioeconomy Coalition here, this is northern Minnesota, southern Minnesota, this is, you know, corn growers and chambers of commerce and farmers union and, you know, all of a wide spectrum of groups, individuals, people with differing perspectives and missions, and they have come together and they continue to just move as a coalition. And I think anytime they move forward and then they hear from one or the other, they kind of have to step back sometimes. And so what I really appreciate is the time that's been taken to prepare this bill. Maybe it's not in the perfect form yet, but I think it's darn close. So I appreciate that Chair Hamilton has brought forth the bill this year. I appreciate, again, Great Plains Institute and everyone that's been involved in the coalition because I think they have done what they've needed to do to continue to put forth this as something we should be talking about, we should be advancing. So I appreciate that, and thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative. Final comment, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And I just didn't want to be remiss in indicating that the Great Plains Institute hasn't responded to some of the concerns or questions I had about water and things like that, because they have made changes in the bill, I think, moving in that direction, and I look forward to continuing to work with them and with Chair Hamilton on the issue. So thank you very much.
Chair Hamilton, any closing comments?
No, I simply ask for your support. Mr. Chairman, I'll renew my motion that House File 536 be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill has passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Chair Hamilton. Any final words of wisdom? No? If not, our committee is adjourned for the day.